You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Caden Tokawingawa. No mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. My name is Caden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Jasmine. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about last weekend's Block the Ban protest for healthcare access for young people with gender dysphoria, a new United Nations report criticising the government's policies towards Māori rights, and the government lowering methane targets against official advice. And I spoke to the University of Auckland's School of Population Health and B416 member, Dr. Samantha Marsh, on why she supports age restrictions for under-16s on social media. And Monday Wire producer Alex spoke to Jacqueline Beggs, a professor in biological sciences at the University of Auckland, about the coming kakapo breeding season and what a good season will mean for the critically endangered bird. Jasmine, what have you got for us today?
Today, I talked to Councillor Shane Henderson about safety on public transport and our beaches this summer, along with the opening of IKEA this week. I also spoke to Professor Chris Bullen to reflect on the success of the 15-year-long smoke-free Aotearoa campaign, and I spoke to Auckland Women's Centre's Leonie Morris about the support needed for victims and professionals ahead of the implementation of the new anti-stalking legislation next May.
Kia ora or whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rāne. Give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka awa e wari wari i ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō. He pakehere rukiruki maronga i te pai. Tukutuku o Erirangi Pōho, mihaere ki 95BFM, erakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309 3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
On Sunday, Block the Ban held a protest against the government's decision to ban new prescriptions of puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria. The United Nations Committee for the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination has released a report warning that New Zealand is at serious risk of weakening Māori rights and entrenching disparities. This is the committee's most critical review, focusing on policies such as scrapping the Māori Health Authority and cutting Māori departments. And last week, the government rejected the recommended methane emissions target. This is despite official warning against the government doing so, stating that lowering methane emissions targets could increase New Zealand's contribution to global warming. Officials said the primary beneficiary of a lower target was the farming sector. However, there was, quote, negligible benefit to overall economic growth from doing so. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about all of these topics. I started by asking if and why he attended the Block the Ban protest over the weekend.
Unfortunately, this was the first time I wasn't able to attend this particular protest. I've stood really strongly in support of our trans and non-binary whānau and their family, because I believe that everyone should have access to the right healthcare, including our young people. The decision by the government has really stirred up concern from families and from communities. They think that this is discriminatory, the decision. And so we saw hundreds of people line up, walk down Queen Street and stand against the government's decision.
It's been a few weeks since this announcement was made. Apart from the most recent protest, what kind of response has there been to this decision?
Well, you've seen PATHA has taken the government to court as a result of their decision. They don't think it's in line with medical standards, and it is in fact discriminatory. That will play out, of course, and a decision will be made, but we know now that it is discriminatory. They've made a political decision on healthcare. That's not what New Zealanders want.
Why do you think the government is continuing to hold their ground despite the pushback?
This decision is a political one. It was agreed within the coalition arrangements of New Zealand First and the ACT Party. They'll use that as the basis for continuing on with their decision. But remember, this government has really doubled down on all marginalised groups, whether that be Māori, whether that be women, disabilities and our rainbow community.
I want to shift and ask about a UN report on the Convention for the End of Racial Discrimination in Aotearoa. What is the impact of a report like this raising concerns about Māori rights?
Well, when I hear from family members that live over in Europe and they ring me and say, what's going on in New Zealand? They are flabbergasted at the decisions of this government and how that's reflecting on us globally. New Zealand is known very well to be a leader in Indigenous rights, but under this government, you know, it's been no surprise, a continued attack on Māoridom, and even to the point last night, under urgency, we're debating the second round of Fast Track, which removes the rights of consultation with iwi and mana whenua.
Will this kind of review actually make a tangible difference or even be listened to by politicians?
It certainly does, because at a global level, people show concern. That influences New Zealanders, that impacts our economy, and impacts people coming here to Aotearoa, because they don't want to participate in an environment that's doubled down and kicked down Indigenous people. And so that's what we're becoming renowned for. But New Zealand needs to stand firm. We love Te Tiriti. We represent the solidarity that the rest of the world is envious of. And most of all, our Indigenous culture really sets us up as being unique across the globe.
Is strengthening New Zealand's position as part of the convention an important goal or way of measuring progress in Aotearoa?
It certainly means that we have support around us. And I think at this particular time where we are vulnerable, we have a government that is making a number of decisions that impact Māori. Race relations in our country has gone back decades. That, you know, it's important that we align ourselves with organisation and with groups that support our kaupapa.
And what is your response to the government ignoring officials when deciding to lower methane emissions targets?
Well, it's no surprise. We've seen legislation after legislation that the government has ignored advice on many things. But we also know that this government isn't committed to reducing emissions. They haven't really followed through on the actions that they promised. And as a result, we're going to impact the lives of our future generation.
Is this another example of the government falling short of international commitments, this time the Paris Agreement?
Yes, it is. Last night, of course, we, under urgency, the government is forcing us to debate legislation that is called Fast Track Round 2. It removes environmental protections and continues on with a series of projects without checks and balances. And so this is a government that demonstrates leadership that doesn't care about the environment, and everyone should be concerned about that.
Is there a risk of hindering economic growth or driving farmers out of business with stricter climate legislation, as the government has said?
Well, certainly there's a risk to our economy when sustainability isn't a part of our decision-making. It's not at the forefront, and that will mean that, you know, business, whether that be farms or whatever, in the future are not sustainable. This government must be held responsible for that, and that's why we're fighting hard against them.
Does this criticism mean Labor is committed to strengthening emissions targets?
Labor's always been committed to strengthening emissions targets. We want to make sure that the settings are right, that we're protecting our future generations, and we will roll out policy in the new year that demonstrates that.
That was Labour's Shannon Halbert on last weekend's Block the Ban protest for healthcare access for young people with gender dysphoria, a new United Nations report criticising the government's policies towards Māori rights and to the government lowering methane targets against official advice.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Safety measures on public transport are of growing concern this week following the fatal and unprovoked attack that took place on Route 76 in East Tāmaki on Monday night. Earlier this week, there were also multiple critical incidents that occurred simultaneously across Auckland's West Coast beaches and waterways, seeing an unusually high deployment of emergency services and surf lifesavers for this early in the summer. And Swedish home and furniture retailer IKEA opened in Sylvia Park a week ago today, drawing huge excitement for many. I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about these topics. Do you have any comments to share about the fatal bus stabbing that occurred in Tāmaki earlier this week?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's been it's been a bit of an emerging issue in recent years, some sort of bad behaviour on public transport and kind of in the public. And obviously, this is sort of the most egregious, sort of terrible thing to have possibly happened. And firstly, my thought goes out to everyone affected, the victims, whānau and friends and everything like that. It's just it's something that we're all kind of grieving with as city leaders. From our perspective, for public transport, we're reviewing the incident as we do through Auckland Transport and seeing what learning we can take forward to sort of make the situation as safe as completely possible. You know, because passengers travelling on board buses and trains, etc., they need to feel safe and they deserve to feel safe. And so we're committed to working with the police and working with partner agencies to do that as much as we can.
And there has been an increase in rescues at West Coast beaches and waterways as summer is getting underway. Could you provide us an overview of Council's role in supporting Surf Life Saving New Zealand and patrol this summer?
Yeah, absolutely. So we regularly provide funding for Surf Life Saving. I think it's a really good thing, a really good spend. You know, because all across Auckland, we have the most amazing beaches in the city. But unfortunately, there are situations every year where people get in trouble. And there's often serious injuries or fatalities. So, you know, the most support we can give to Surf Life Saving, the better. And, you know, my first message is that if you want to check if the beach is safe, first have a look at the Safe Swim, you know, app, which is a fantastic resource. So just Google that and have a bit of a look in there and look up your beach and see whether it's safe. Just be, you know, as cautious and careful as possible, especially with a beach that you don't necessarily know. Being a West Auckland councillor, I'd also have to put, you know, don't fish in places, for example, which are slippery off rocks and things like that. That can be a situation where we have big problems in Piha every year in particular. So those are some tips for summer. But, you know, have fun and enjoy our city because we've got the most amazing beaches that we could possibly have.
And the talk of Tāmaki this week has been IKEA opening at Sylvia Park. What does this opening mean for our city?
I think it's a really great sign for our economic recovery and economic development. The more that we can welcome these big brands, international brands that are very popular to our city, the better. And honestly, I think there's a real optimism around the business community around there and in the wider community of West Auckland where this stuff can really catalyse economic activity. Haven't been there myself. I can't wait to go check it out, though, because it's pretty exciting stuff. And the one other thing that I would add is that it was really encouraging to see so many people taking public transport there to the opening. That's really exciting. That's a really cool thing that we can do.
Just to wrap us up for the year, what is the atmosphere in council like leading up to the holiday season?
For us as city leaders, we went through the election this year and then straight into some really big reforms which will take us through, honestly, the rest of the term. So we just need a bit of a break and a bit of sunshine this summer. Look, I will say for the public out there, pools and leisure centres, they're open through summer and it's just a fantastic place to go check out, especially with the family. Council rangers, summer rangers will be really busy with regional parks, conservation, pest control, that kind of stuff. And I just encourage Aucklanders to go out and enjoy our beautiful forests, our beautiful beaches, and obviously city services like libraries and pools that are fantastic as well.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson about safety on public transport and our beaches this summer, along with the opening of IKEA.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts 5395.
Here at 95BFM, we ran out of ideas for merch, so we got the kids to do it. And honestly, the future of graphic design is in excellent hands.
We've just dropped a 95 BFM Kids Show tee, and it's been designed by one very talented Kids Show listener. Thanks, mate. We've also got staple tees and hats available to purchase. So get your summer outfit sorted and pre-order your 95 BFM merch now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
You're listening to Talking Tracks on PBNZ.
And as I said, Frith, if this harpsichord is gauche, then what's Max Martin? Seriously though, a crisp and ebullient debut from this young artist. Mm. And now from our new contributor, Daryl.
Yeah, mate.
Are you trying to humiliate me?
No.
Is this funny to you? Screeching uncultured no-fi bullshit? Get out!
Real pain for sham friends. Dirtbag Radio. For real friends.
Cause I wanna go out and get drunk and dance.
Dirtbag Radio. Mondays 7 to 9pm with Rapley. Thanks to Go Cooler Music, Auckland's newest secondhand music store at 370A Broadway Newmarket. Only on 95BFM.
Mixtape was sad. She saw shows with specific themes and thought, who am I? Then one day she realised that she'd been lovingly crafted by her father Sam for a greater purpose, to guide people into their Sunday the right way. She would fulfil her mission, no matter the cost.
The Sunday Mixtape. Expect the latest drops, the deepest cuts, and everything in between. The Sunday Mixtape with your host Sam. Sundays 9 till 10am, right here on 95BFM.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
Yesterday was the first day of the ban on social media for under-16s in Australia. A similar ban is being pushed for in New Zealand, largely by the advocacy group Before 16. National Party MP Catherine Weird has a members' bill to put in place an age restriction for under-16s on social media, but the legislation has not been supported by the ACT Party, who say they want to see how the ban plays out in Australia first. I spoke to a member of Before 16 and senior research fellow at the University of Auckland School of Population Health, Dr. Samantha Marsh, about why she supports a ban and her response to some of the criticism of a ban. I started by asking if she could explain why she supports a social media ban for under 16s.
So at the moment we have a commercial product that almost all teenagers are using in New Zealand. So we know that 90% of teens are on these platforms and they're on there for many hours every day. And there's increasingly robust research that is showing that these platforms are harming our kids. So, you know, we have a commercial product where our kids are, and yet it's largely unregulated right now. So, you know, people will say that we just need to make design changes, you know, that these companies are going to change their product, which I absolutely agree with. I think that we really need to be pushing for that stuff. But under the current commercial model, I just don't think it's realistic to pretend that they're going to make such significant changes to their product that they're going to be safe for our kids' developing brains. So I really see social media age restrictions as a way to remove our kids from a very harmful environment while we try and figure out how to make it safe. Because I don't think leaving them on those platforms when we know it's, you know, increasingly trying to understand that it's unsafe, that, you know, we're just hoping that change is going to happen, but we're going to leave them there in the meantime, because I don't really think that's fair on kids.
What about young people who depend on social media for community? For example, rainbow young people who might feel isolated at home or at school.
Yeah, so there's some really good research looking at how, you know, the rainbow community use social media and these platforms. But what research actually shows, you know, from the highest quality research, and that's not just relying on what young people are saying, but actually looking at, you know, their level of distress when they're on social media. And it shows that actually the dominant narrative in Rainbow Youth is that it's not a safe place for them. And those kids who say that it is and it's really important for connection, they're actually more likely to be harmed by social media. So I think that's part of the argument, is that, you know, these kids are actually more vulnerable to harm on social media. Now, that's not to say that they aren't getting some benefits from that connection. And so what I think is important is we need to realise that we shouldn't be keeping a whole generation of like 11, 12, 13-year-olds on a platform that can lead to harm in order for a smaller proportion of kids to connect online. What we should be doing is figuring out how we can create safer spaces for those kids to get the benefits of connection, but that aren't on a commercial product, commercial platform that's designed to, you know, overwhelm their brains and have addictive qualities about it. You know, it's why don't we pour our money into figuring out a way to connect these kids both online and offline?
Some youth advocacy groups like Gen Z Aotearoa say the government should do more meaningful consultation with young people before this ban goes through. Is that something you'd support?
Yeah, I think, you know, talking to young people is really important. You know, when I talk to young people about this topic, you know, they come with their ideas and then, you know, we talk about how social media is actually designed to, you know, target them and how, you know, the business model behind it, how it's not actually for their benefit. And then after a while, you know, they begin to see the problem differently. So I think if we're going to work with young people, we need to educate those young people first, because just because you have experience of using something, it doesn't actually mean that you have expertise in a topic. You can't understand how this impacts your brain development and things like that. So yes, I think, you know, we need to talk to young people, but let's educate them first. The other part of it, which I think is often missed, is that, you know, we're asking young people to solve a complex public health problem when they don't have the knowledge to do that. But it also means that we're making them responsible for generations of children that are going to come after them. And I think we need to be careful there.
And I want to ask about the mental health aspect of this, especially given the context that some vocal mental health or youth mental health advocates like Jazz Thornton and Youthline say a blanket ban is not a good idea. What is your response to this?
Yeah, so they'll often say that a blanket ban's not a good idea. First of all, it's not a blanket ban, but, you know, they use words like prohibition and things. This is an age restriction up to 16. That's all it is. It's not a blanket ban. You know, everybody else can use social media. I think, you know, we need to be careful with listening to influencers in a space, because they're, you know, that's actually how they get a lot of their income and things like that, has been influencers. So, you know, they have an agenda there. Also, with respect to Youthline, you know, if you look at the Youthline research, and young people say that this is one of their biggest cause for, you know, concern, and that they're worried about it and they think it's impacting on their well-being. What they also say is that currently social media is where they're at, so that's where it's easiest for people to reach them to provide help. And because of that, it seems to be this push that we need to keep kids on this platform because that's where they're going to get help. I don't think we should leave kids on a platform that is negatively impacting on their mental health just because it's also an easy way to connect with them. I think we need to, you know, hopefully get them off these platforms and then find other ways to reach them and provide support.
What about those who worry this could impact digital rights or freedom of expression?
Well, I think that's, you know, freedom of expression is a very interesting one, because these are commercial products with algorithms driving content to them and, you know, manipulating our cognitive biases and things like that, we don't really even have free will when we're on social media. So without free will, you don't have freedom of expression and all these rights that, you know, people are talking about. And I think that people need to realise that those rights, you know, they come at a cost too. And they're coming at a cost of protecting children's well-being.
And I just want to finish by asking, for you personally, why is 16 the age you think is appropriate for social media access?
So 16 is a very pragmatic age. So We've got research that shows that kids younger than that, so girls between 11 and 13, boys between 14 and 15, that seems to be a particularly vulnerable age to the harms of social media, so it's trying to avoid that. It's also early adolescence is a very important time for brain development, and so we want to get kids past that developmental window as much as we can before we give them access to these platforms. Having said that, nothing exceptional happens on your 16th birthday. And from a personal view, I will not be letting my kids on at 16. I will wait until they're old enough to, buy their own phones and get on at 18 or whatever. It's based on the research. It's based on what we know about brain development. And it's pragmatic. It's a pragmatic decision for choosing 16.
That was University of Auckland School of Population Health and Before 16 member Dr. Samantha Marsh on why she supports age restrictions for under 16s on social media, as well as her response to some of the criticisms.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
With 2025 coming to a close, it's a turning point for health promotion strategies around nicotine and tobacco use in Aotearoa. The Smoke-Free Aotearoa 2025 initiative launched in 2010 and sought to focus on addressing inequities for Māori. The parameters for success for Smoke-Free Aotearoa aim for a reduction to less than 5% of New Zealanders that smoke across all population groups by the end of the 15-year period. I spoke to Professor Chris Bullen, co-chair of the Smoke-Free Expert Advisory Committee, about the changes in smoking culture that have occurred across the campaign and what is next for addressing inequities in tobacco use and relevant health outcomes going forward. Kia ora, Chris. In your view, how effective has the Smoke-Free campaign been in aligning with changes in smoking culture in Aotearoa since 2010?
Well, I'd say that we've been in some ways spectacularly successful, because since about 2010, the rate of smoking in New Zealand overall has come down dramatically. So it was around 5 years ago, it was around about 12% in adults were smoking every day. That's now pretty much halved, but there are pretty big differences between males, females, ethnic groups, different age groups, and people on different income levels. So when you factor that variation, for some people or groups of people, it's been more successful than others, and that's probably the biggest challenge we face.
And how impactful has it been to collate the address of different means of nicotine use, especially considering the rise of vaping, under the one smoke-free umbrella?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one, because this, what we call the landscape of nicotine and tobacco products, is changing constantly and very fast. So when I first started doing research into smoking, really that was all there was, it was smoking. And around about 2010 to 2012, vapes started appearing on the market, but they were very different from what you see people using today. They were pretty clunky, they leaked, they were not that great, actually. And then around about 2018-19, they changed dramatically to become more like what they are today, like the disposables, little sleek products, which are much easier for people to use. So, and then we've now got heated tobacco products like IQOS, which is around for sale legally in New Zealand, and people are using oral tobacco nicotine products, sort of little pouches, mini tea bags, which aren't legal for sale, but people can obtain them for personal use and are accessing them from online sales. So the whole range of products in that period of time has changed a lot. And so what was a smoke-free banner, it kind of includes all those things, but people are increasingly now talking about nicotine-free Aotearoa. So that's where the conversation has shifted, because of the diversity of nicotine products on the market.
What is the biggest challenge in addressing smoking culture in Aotearoa at this stage, especially moving from that smoke-free Aotearoa towards that nicotine-free Aotearoa, as you say?
Yeah, so I think there are a number of challenges, but probably I think one of the biggest is the really big picture, which is about how the tobacco industry influences decision-making in Aotearoa. So that sort of is behind the scenes. We've got paid lobbyists working for tobacco companies trying their best to get our politicians to make decisions which slow down the reduction in smoking and favour these quite addictive other nicotine products coming into the marketplace. So I think unless we tackle that fundamental problem of industry influence, just as we see this happening in the food space as well, it's very hard to actually get rid of the problem completely. So I think that's one kind of big macro challenge that we have to face. And the other is when you talked about smoking culture, I think within some population groups, it's still the norm to smoke, even though, you know, when you wander down the road, smoking is really, really uncommon now. But in certain settings or with population groups, for example, people who have a problem with other drug dependence or mental health conditions, smoking is still very common. And they're more likely to die prematurely from a smoking-related illness than they are from the mental health condition that might they might have had for many years. So I think that's one group in the population. And among Māori women, while smoking's come down dramatically, in some rural communities up north and east coast, it's probably still almost more common to be a smoker than not. So I think those things are really hard to shift, but they can be shifted, as we've seen across the decades. But it takes a lot of work and, you know, working in different ways than perhaps we've worked in the past. You know, like mass media maybe doesn't hit people like it used to, but maybe more focused, targeted work in communities is probably likely to be more effective.
And could you provide us any insight into the initiatives that might be coming up or the strategies that may be being used to address these inequitable outcomes for certain population groups, as you say, going forward in the health promotion initiatives for smoke-free and nicotine-free Aotearoa?
Yeah, well, there is a lot of great work being done by people who work in their communities, who are working with people who smoke and vape every day, or with teenagers who vape, who want to get off vaping, for example. So there is a lot of great work being done out there by often people who live in those communities and are known. And so I think that's mobilising those kind of grassroots strengths and expertise of understanding how to reach their communities is a really powerful way of helping to shift the sort of social norms in those contexts. So I think we need to continue doing more of that. But that needs to be supported by policies which help to motivate people, like keeping the price of tobacco high is really important, and trying to get rid of cheap smuggled cigarettes. Otherwise, people will just find ways to get access to those cheaper products. Because price is probably the most important factor that governments can introduce to control smoking, stop young people starting, and motivate people to quit. And then there's lots of other things that can be done. For example, just keeping an eye on social media particularly, and the other media. We noticed that smoking is kind of coming back in as being a cool thing in music clips, video clips on TikTok and in films. So we kind of have to keep monitoring what's going on in behaviour and what's kind of becoming regarded as being, you know, slightly rebellious or cool again, and try and get our messaging right to adapt. So it's kind of constant watch the space and being able to respond quickly with good information for people. I mean, at the end of the day, it's all about people having long, healthy lives and not suffering from, you know, premature disease and death and incapacity due to problems like smoking. So that's the objective we're all hoping to achieve through these strategies like smoke-free or nicotine-free Aotearoa.
That was Professor Chris Bullen, co-chair of the Smoke-Free Expert Advisory Committee on the status of Smoke-Free Aotearoa 2025 as the 15-year health promotion campaign nears its end, paving way for new initiatives.
So around, you know, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. This is After the First Kiss from Faye Webster.
Dramatic clear picture when I close my eyes. After the first kiss, I woke up lost in her room. Asked for her last name, 'cause I never knew. After first kiss, she met my mom real soon. After first kiss, she got me deep in tears.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
The kakapo is among our most critically endangered birds, having barely crawled back from the brink of extinction in the 90s. But those working with kakapo remain hopeful, and predictions for the coming breeding season show promise. While there is still room for such a season to fall short, a successful breeding season would show hope for our native birds, even amidst the growing worry over the climate and continued threat from predators. Producer Alex spoke to Jacqueline Beggs, Professor of Biological Sciences at the University of Auckland, about this breeding season and what it means for kakapo and other native birds.
Can you just run us through what you're expecting from this current coming kakapo breeding season?
Well, we're expecting that the kakapo will respond to the large amount of rimu fruit that we think is coming, and that they will potentially have a record breeding season.
Within the context of the current situation for the kakapo population, what is that situation like, and how important is a successful big breeding season for kakapo?
Well, it's huge, actually. Kakapo are nationally critically endangered. So although the numbers have recovered hugely from when it hit a low in 1995 of 51 birds, so we're now, 270-odd birds, which is fantastic, but they are still critically endangered, which means that we need these big breeding seasons, as frequently and as successfully as we can manage to get those birds out of this dire situation that they're in.
And so looking at that 270-odd birds, if this big breeding season comes through and does go successfully and the predictions are correct, what will we see for this population? How many birds can we expect to be be hatched?
There could be a really big increase, but I don't want to put a specific number on. I think it's too early for that. We've got a long way to go. We don't actually count the chicks as being added to the population until September in 2026. So they've got to, the birds have to boom, they have to mate, they have to lay the eggs and successfully hatch, and then the fruit has to come in. And so it's, there's a lot of ends that have to line up before we know how many. But what we do know is we've got 84 breeding age females, and there's a good chance that they will all give it a shot.
Could you walk us through, so after this breeding season, after these chicks hatch, what sort of processes do we want to see for these young birds going into adulthood? What needs to happen for them to reach independence, and then what do we want to see from that independent population?
What we need most of all is for the rimu fruit to ripen. So at the moment, the signs are that the rimu has set a lot of fruit, but we need good conditions, weather conditions, for the fruit to ripen. And then we need a whole lot of things to line up in terms of good interaction between the males and females, obviously. It's all about sex. We've got to have the mating and the eggs to be fertile. And then, you know, and then there's things left field that can interfere, like disease or those sorts of things. So, yeah, that's what why I say there's a lot of stars that need to align until we get those chicks independent at the, you know, towards the end of 2026.
And you mentioned weather there. Is looking wider outside of just this season, what are the concerns like for kākāpō populations when it comes to climate change and kind of weather becoming more volatile? Is there a real concern that that is going to seriously interrupt attempts to kind of help these populations?
It's an interesting one because it's ecologically there's several interactions that come into play potentially. One is the timing of the rimu fruiting, which the chicks rely on that fruit, that is influenced by the frequency of, you know, the specific climate conditions that they need for the rimu to fruit. So typically it fruits between every 2 to 6 years. Potentially, global warming means that it will fruit more frequently, which potentially means that's an advantage to the kākāpō. But the other thing that it can interplay with is the mammalian predators, and they are also responding to, you know, climatic variation, and that's likely to potentially go the other way, making conditions worse for them. So I don't know, kind of need a crystal ball on that one.
And just looking at how kākāpō are critically endangered and kind of comparing that to other native birds, how does the precariousness of these populations compare to other endangered birds like kiwi or like those less endangered like tui?
Yeah, well, I think they are, the birds are all on a continuum really, and kākāpō had got to the level where they were right at one end of the continuum and about to go extinct. But it's all the same factors at play that make many of our native species vulnerable. So it's the introduced stoats, rats, cats, you know, all those predators, which our birds just haven't evolved. They've no idea what to do in the face of a mammalian predator. And so some species are more vulnerable than others. So kākāpō in particular, because they're on the ground a lot and they're slow to breed. And so there's various characteristics that make some species worse than others, but essentially they're vulnerable to the similar sorts of things. And so that's where initiatives like Predator for Free 2050 and all the amazing mahi that groups are doing around the country trying to get on top of those invasive species is so important, not just for kākāpō, but for all of our wildlife.
Kind of on that, with this potentially beneficial mating boom for kākāpō and the way that the trajectory of their population is going up, does this show promise for other birds as well?
Yes, I think it does, in the sense that it really highlights the need for these predator-free areas, or if we can't achieve predator-free, even predator-reduced numbers. And kākāpō really highlight that because they require large areas. And so it's one of the challenges that the kākāpō recovery is facing now is where do we put all these birds? We've just about run out of the suitable, highly protected offshore islands that are predator-free. And so now we're having to look at where's the next most safe place to put them. And if we keep, you know, succeeding with getting the numbers up, the requirement for those big predator-reduced areas just becomes higher and higher. And that provides good habitat for a whole range of other species will benefit from that as well.
And kind of just to look to wrap up, with that, what more do you want to see in terms of maybe government or other organisations? What sort of work still needs to be done in terms of kind of establishing those safe zones, but also encouraging these bird populations to breed and to bounce back?
I think the story with predator control and these, you know, we need long-term enduring solutions, and we can't afford to take our foot off the pedal because a government might see the priorities here or there. Like, these birds are really sensitive to these predators, and we know we're not there yet, and we know it's going to take a long time with a lot of investment to get to where we're happy that these birds and many other species are secure in New Zealand. So it needs long-term thinking. It needs buy-in from the community. It needs working with tangata whenua to make sure that, you know, we have that holistic long-term view that will carry us through. You know, nature doesn't work in short-term political cycles. You know, it works across large spaces and time frames. And so I think we've got to get better at that.
That was Monday Wire producer Alex speaking to the University of Auckland's Jacqueline Beggs about the expected breeding season for kākāpō and what it means for our flightless parrot.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
On May 26 next year, Aotearoa's anti-stalking legislation comes into effect, but criminalisation is not the only action needed to support those experiencing stalking. Earlier this week, Auckland Women's Centre released a guide of referral for victims of stalking that includes advice on reporting to police and accessing support services. I spoke to Auckland Women's Centre's Leonie Morris, project lead for Aotearoa Free from Stalking, on the advocacy pathways needed to best address the issue of stalking ahead of the legislation implementation next year. Tell us about the new support guide for stalking victims that Auckland's Women's Centre has released in the last week.
Yes, we created a stalking response guide. So what that means, of course, is giving all the different ways that a person who's been stalked can respond to stalking. So we did this, we created this in collaboration with many different community groups so that we ensured we had different perspectives like Rainbow, Takatāpui, disabled, ethnic, etc. And the guide, it's really, it's a great place to go if you think you're being stalked and you want, or you just want to understand stalking, or you know you're being stalked and you need support. So it's really got everything in it that you could possibly want, but it is divided neatly into sections, so you can just look at, you know, what are my legal rights section, or which is the best organisation to support me section. So, yeah, we're very pleased with it. We think it will be very helpful for the community, and we are going to update it when the new law comes into effect, because actually while the law's been passed, it doesn't come into effect until the 26th of May.
Ahead of this new law coming into effect in May, could you comment on the importance of the level of trust that the public have with police in order for this legislation to be effective?
That's such an important issue. For years, women have gone to the police with maybe family violence concerns or sexual violence concerns or maybe stalking concerns, and the police have minimised their fear and harm. And just said very unhelpful things like, you know, try not to focus on it. I'm sure he'll calm down soon and things will be back to normal. Really minimising violence against women. So this is a huge issue for us. It always has been. There's been many academic research reports that have found exactly what I'm saying to you. And then, of course, we have the McSkimming fiasco. And what was really notable for us about that was that so many top policemen, and some women, but mainly policemen, were told the story that a woman, the complaints authority refers to her as Ms. Z, that she had allegations against McSkimming. And so many of those men that were told that story believed McSkimming without asking any questions, just automatically assumed that, oh yeah, poor man, this is the situation where a woman's been scorned and she's lashing out. And that's just so horrifying to us that so many of those police officers didn't say, has her complaint been investigated? Nobody said that for months. And then we find out, of course, that there is substance to her complaint. So, you know, we kind of feel a little bit like we've gone backwards. There was the Blasey report, I think it was 2004, which was done after Louise Nicholas was treated so badly by the police. And they came up with a whole plan for the police to look at their internal sexism and attitude. And another thing that's disturbing to us is that the police aren't talking about going back to that plan and looking at what they implemented then and what worked, what they didn't implement then and perhaps should have. And so now we're just finding history repeating itself.
So what measures do you feel are needed to support the legislation in its debut next year?
We think there needs to be really thorough police training, and that needs to not only look at how to recognise stalking when it's being presented to you, but also the other matters that I've been talking about of affirming the victim's experience and, you know, and supporting her and believing her. That needs to be all part of the training. I mean, obviously they investigate everything. That's just part of their job. But in the past, they've dismissed women's concerns just right off the bat. And so they need to have a lot of discussion around that as part of their training. The other thing that we really feel is needed is specialist stalking advocates. Lots of reasons for this. One is that stalking is a very unusual crime. If someone bashes me in the face, then that's obvious to everybody that a crime's committed. But if someone just does a number of unwanted intrusion into my life, like, you know, putting feces in my letterbox and then maybe creating a fake social media account as me and putting all sorts of nonsense on it, it's hard for people to realise that that is a crime. That is stalking, and it is a crime. And we need stalking advocates so that they can support the person that's been targeted with the stalking and help them to, you know, gather the evidence they might need to understand their legal rights and all the next steps and the best agencies to help them. And we also think that if we had these specialist stalking advocates, this would assist the police, because it means that the victim is going to come to the police very clear about how and what way the law is being broken and with their evidence and what they need from the police. Whereas, if there isn't that kind of intermediary it's going to take a long time for the police to do this work. And the police are already saying they're under-resourced. So, you know, they're going to get a lot more stalking complaints. And how are they going to handle these when they're currently under-resourced?
What is top of mind for you then regarding this kaupapa and your mahi between now and the legislation coming into effect next year?
Top of mind is that the government does this work now, that it starts training the police immediately, and we know they're going to train them, but we do need them to train them very thoroughly and in a way that encourages their sympathy towards stalking victims. And we also need the government to set up specialist stalking advocates. One thing about stalking is that about 60% of it is in the context of family violence. So if that's happening to you or anybody you know, the best people to go to are Women's Refuge or Shine, because they are the experts and they're well-resourced. But 40%, which is a large minority, is not about family violence. It's a neighbourly dispute that went wrong. It's somebody at your work that you accidentally upset. It's, you know, maybe an old friend that you somehow you've got into a dispute with. And right now, there's not a lot of support for those people, which is another reason that we really need a specialist stalking advocate.
That was Leonie Morris, project lead for Aotearoa Free from Stalking, on the advocate support needed for success of the incoming anti-stalking legislation in May 2026. Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Shane Henderson, University of Auckland's Dr Samantha Marsh, Professor Chris Willen, and Jacqueline Beggs, and the Auckland Women's Centre's Leonie Morris. You're listening to 95 BFM. Next up is The Wonderful with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.